And we're with Robert Zubrin this hour, Merchants of Despair, his latest work. He's also written a book called The Case for Mars, how he supports our plan to settle the red planet. But when will we do that? I want to get his take on some of these space issues that are coming up as well. And we will take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Zubrin with us. Robert, I want to get your reaction to the privatization of space. I mean, here we are, private company going up to the International Space Station. Do you think that's good? Do you think NASA should be doing this?
Oh, no, this is very good. Now, you should understand that two-thirds of the money came from NASA.
That's right.
But one-third did come from Elon Musk. And because he was not doing this as a cost-plus contract, because he had some skin in the game, he did this, the development of the Falcon and the Dragon, for about one-tenth the cost of what has come to be accepted in mainstream aerospace contracting. And, now what we have to get out of this, though, is not just, well, gee, now we have a cheaper way to get to the space station. We got to get out of this is to realize that it's now very clear that it can be affordable for us to go to Mars.
How can he do it at one-tenth the cost and government can't?
Well, the reason is this, is he's not looking at this program as a way to fill up time cards, give people a contract to charge against. And he's doing this program as if it was his own money that he spent.
It's like a business to him.
Because it is. Mm-hmm. So he's looking to do this in minimum cost, in minimum time. And by the way, those two things go together. In aerospace, cost is people times time. The longer you take to do something, the more it costs. I mean, NASA has been working on a crew capsule to go to the space station since 2003. And they have spent I don't know how many billions on this, and they still have no plans to have the thing flying for years. And basically, that's how they've been proceeding along with their principal contractors. Now, what Musk did by taking this what is the minimum cost way to put together a capsule to send people to the station? He created this capsule in just a few years at a total program cost of around $300 million, plus another $300 million to create the Falcon 9. Now, that Falcon 9, that's a medium-lift launch vehicle, can lift about 10 tons to Earth orbit. He did it for $300 million. He told the Augustine Commission, which was this big commission that Obama put together to give it advice on space policy, that he could develop a heavy-lift vehicle for $2.5 billion. Heavy-lift vehicle might be 100 tons to orbit, about 10 times what the Falcon 9 can do. But given that he did the Falcon 9 for about one-tenth of that, then his bid is entirely credible, 100% credible. Meantime, you got the Augustine Commission saying, well, we can't go back to the moon because it needs a heavy lift vehicle, and that would cost $36 billion to develop. I don't know how they came up with that number. That was high even by industry standards by at least a factor of three. But still, there it is. Now, look, if Musk can develop a heavy lift vehicle for $2.5 billion, that's the biggest single thing that you need in order to go to Mars, the biggest single hardware procurement. He could probably do a Humans to Mars program for $10 billion. So here is what I think.
And soon, too.
And soon. Here's what I think they ought to do, okay? They ought to, instead of NASA saying, oh, we dream we'll go to Mars, in the year 2047, just give us $10 billion a year and we'll let you know when we're ready to start, they should just put out a request for proposals to the industry. It shouldn't be sole source to Musk, but he should, of course, get a chance to bid.
Sure.
Say, look, we want one of you companies to bid on sending humans to Mars and bringing them back. And you have to do it within 10 years, and bids of over $20 billion will be considered non-responsive. I believe Musk would bid. I believe his bid would come in at less than $10 billion. My guess is Lockheed Martin and Boeing would also bid, and their bids would be less than $20
billion. Would there be any foreign companies that could bid?
Well, that would be up to Congress. I think there are reasons to have the money go to an American company.
I agree.
I think that given the extreme importance of space for national security, that it's extremely important that we have a healthy and vibrant aerospace industry here, and that we should spend American tax dollars on to go to American companies. But they got to put in competitive bids, and they would under these conditions. And then these proposals would be rated on the basis of cost, scientific exploration capability, and technical credibility, just like any other procurement. And we could have humans to Mars within 10 years for, 5% of NASA's budget.
Because there's no title to Mars, if a private company goes there, don't they own it?
It's unclear. There is no law currently that establishes that. There was a Outer Space Treaty of 1967 prevents any claims of national sovereignty over extraterrestrial bodies. In other words, the United States can't claim Mars. China can't claim
Right.
Mars. Okay. But exactly what private property means in the absence of a government is unclear.
That would be strange.
Huh? All right, because, in other words, look, the reason why you own your house is because there's a police force that agrees that you do.
And they can take it if you don't make your payments.
Or they can evict people who move into your house without your permission.
That's true.
Okay. This, by the way, is a problem for this other private space venture that people have been talking about recently, which is this one started by Peter Diamandis.
Yeah.
Just had
Peter on a few weeks ago.
Mine asteroids. His business plan would be a lot stronger if there was a way that people who explore asteroids could stake claims on them, because then
you
wouldn't necessarily have to mine the asteroid to make money. You could just stake claims and then sell the claims based on their future value when better technology is available that people could mine them. If we had laws in place right now that allowed people to stake claims on asteroids, it would be very possible for companies like Peter's to be quite profitable and do space exploration for profit. Now, I actually put forth a proposal for this a number of years ago, and I think it's discussed in The Case for Mars or Entering Space, perhaps one of my other space books, which is that the U.S. government establish something analogous to a patent office whereby anyone, and this would include foreign nationals, just like the U.S. Patent Office mm-hmm. does grant patents to foreign nationals, who explored an asteroid or a part of the moon or a part of Mars to a specified degree of fidelity to stake a claim to the mineral rights there. And this would not amount to a U.S. claim of national sovereignty on these asteroids any more than the U.S. Patent Office is creating a claim to the universe of ideas. And in fact, the U.S. Patent Office is of great benefit to foreign inventors. Let's say you're a Finnish inventor and you invent some invention. A Finnish patent doesn't do you a hell of a lot of good, but a U.S. patent does, because then if somebody wants to produce your product using your invention for the U.S. market, they have to buy your rights. You actually have intellectual property that means something. So this would benefit space exploration countries of all nations if the United States established a mining patent office for space.
Okay, let's take some calls here with you, Robert. Let's go to Joe in Brooklyn, California. You can't be in Brooklyn. Where are you, Joe?
Hi, how are you?
Good. Where are you calling from?
Calling from New York.
Okay, good. With a little typo on my machine.
Yeah, I believe that the space program should be, NASA should continue to be funded by, funding should increase. NASA's been a great incubator for technology. Because the Apollo program has created lots of technology that created the technology boom of the 80s, 90s, and 2000 and recent years because of microtechnology, microchips, and also certain lots of technologies were developed through the space program. Also, I believe that the moon may have helium-3. Some people say that it could be used for possibly fusion or fission, and that could possibly solve our energy problems.
What do you think of that, Robert?
Well, all those statements are true. I would only modify them in certain ways. NASA certainly did produce technology spin-offs from its efforts during Apollo, as the caller said. But actually, the bigger spinoff was not the creation of technologies, but the creation of intellectual capital by inspiring millions of young people to become scientists, engineers, medical researchers, technological entrepreneurs. It's intellectual capital, the basis of the wealth of a nation. And, you know, youth loves adventure. And what Apollo did was make science the great adventure. And it doubled the number of science graduates in this country at every level, high school, college, PhD. And, you know, who are these 40-year-old techno geeks that created Silicon Valley in the 1990s? They were the 12-year-old little boy mad scientists of the 1960s making rocket fuel in the basement. And having an inspiring program, having a program that makes science the great adventure as the Humans to Mars program would today, would be of enormous value to our economy, national defense, public health, all these things, because all these things are created by scientific minds. And as for the helium-3 on the moon, that is there. That is true. Of course, we have to develop fusion power to make use of it, but I think that can be done. But you know, what all these things show, all these things are the refutations to the merchants of despair, because fusion power, you're talking about a resource that is a million times greater in its extent than all the fossil fuels on Earth combined. And so all these guys that say, well, we're running out of fuels, they don't recognize the fact, or they refuse to admit the fact, that human beings create resources. I mean, we didn't have oil until we invented oil drilling. Before that, we used whale oil.
That's right.
Okay, and, you know, we don't have to use petroleum oil forever. We can use nuclear fission and then fusion.
Why can't we get to this fusion? Why can't we start developing it?
Well, actually, it's been strangled by government budget cuts. U.S. fusion program right now is like $400 million a year, which, you know, what's that? That's less than one shuttle flight. I mean, it's that's basically $1.25 per American per year. Okay, it's not enough. And given the importance of this, and by the way, and some of these anti-human organizations have come out opposing the development of fusion power because they say it would give so much energy would make unlimited growth possible. And that is true. And that's why they're against it. And that's why the rest of us should be for it.
Okay, back to the phones. Josie in Richmond, Virginia. Go ahead, Josie. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Following right along with that lead of fuel, there is a very, very inexpensive and a very safe fuel that I've heard about called thorium. And I don't think it should be so expensive. And it should carry people everywhere, as well as power plants, as well as under the ocean, wherever. But to get to Mars, cheaper and safer, would thorium be a possibility of a good idea?
Well, sure. Thorium is about 10 times more common than uranium, so it greatly expands the amount of nuclear fission power that we have, and test thorium reactors have already been built. So unlike fusion, where we still have to master some fundamental technical challenges, which I think we can master, thorium, we know how to use thorium in a fission reactor. And the amount of these resources are vast. I mean, I'll tell you, let me put it to you in money terms, okay? Were to take all the oil in the world and you were to use it to make electricity and sell the electricity at 7 cents a kilowatt hour, which is a medium rate of what it goes for, and you divide that money from all that oil among the 7 billion people on the planet, your share would be $18,000. If you take coal, it'd be $69,000. Natural gas, another $18,000. If you take nuclear fission with just uranium and no fuel reprocessing, it's $60,000. If you take nuclear fission with thorium and reprocessing, it's $17 million.
Wow.
Okay. And if you take nuclear fusion, it's $8 trillion.
That's the way to go.
Yeah. So that if all these energy resources are the common heritage of mankind, the people who are trying to stop nuclear power are trying to chip you out of $17 million, because that's your share.
Robert, what are the countries right now that literally can go into space, not just launch, but go into space? U.S., China, India, Russia. Who else can do this?
The Europeans.
Europeans is a group.
Japan.
Okay.
And a limited capability in Brazil.
Can Pakistan do it?
No.
They cannot. Who's on the horizon of being able to do this? Iran?
Yes. Iran is close to orbital capability.
How about, why hasn't Israel ever done this?
Actually, Israel has. Israel has.
Oh, they have. Okay.
A small launch vehicle. Yes, Israel can launch small payloads into space.
All right. Well, it seems like a growing society. Now, why aren't we all doing this as a team?
Well, there are certain ventures that we are doing as a team, such as the space station, which is a cooperative venture basically of the United States, of the European Union, Russia, and Japan. That cooperation has pluses and minuses to it. You know, we had a much more dynamic space program when we were doing it in competition with the Russians. Once we all decided to cooperate, then there's no rush. Right?
That's true.
No one is going to run faster than you. And by the way, this has been a problem with the fusion program, too. I used to work in the fusion program. And in the 80s, there was a real horse race on. And, you know, at every conference, the Americans would try to show up the Russians by having the greatest results. Or the Russians would come in and they'd announce plans for a new and bigger test machine or something. And this was going on. And then around 1986, heads of the various fusion research agencies got together and they said, why are we having all this wasteful competition? Why don't we all cooperate on one project? And so they did. They basically stopped pushing their own projects and all decided to cooperate on one project called ITER, the International Tokamak Experimental Reactor. And they spent the next 23 years discussing where to put it. Okay, and so... And I've got a graph of this in Merchants of Despair that shows the progress of the fusion program up through the end of the 1980s, because there was still some progress going on in the second half of the 80s based on the machines that had just been built or were about to be built. But since around 1992, there's been no progress in the fusion program at all because the international competition has stopped. Now, competition, whether it's in the fusion program or space, doesn't have to be hostile. We can have Olympic-style competition. I mean, imagine how dull the Olympics would be if before the games the coaches all got together and decided, well, we'll let Russia win the high jump, but the Americans can take the 50-yard dash. I mean, it doesn't work. Okay, if you want to have excellence, you got to have competition.
Well, no doubt. Robert, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment to continue taking phone calls with you here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Zubrin, his latest book, Merchants of Despair, fascinating read and a great investigation over what they're trying to do, the very powerful, the unprincipled elites who want to take over just about everything. I'll just say everything on this planet. We'll do that. And split show tonight, so later on, in just a moment, next hour, the Modern Book of the Dead, as we talk about a perspective on death and the soul and what happens in the life to come. All that and much more just ahead on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. Well, tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Eastern time, Glynis McCants joins us in our Coast Insiders chat. So make sure you get in there and the room fills up very fast. She'll be talking about your personal months and what things will be doing. She'll be giving some individual readings as well. Should be a lot of fun. Glynis McCants on our little chat tomorrow for Coast Insiders starts at 8 p.m. Pacific time. And welcome back. Robert Zubrin with us. Your phone calls as well. Robert, the book, Merchants of Despair, where can people get it?
Oh, you can get it at Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. It's in many bookstores. There's also a website, merchantsofdespair.com, where people can see some of my short articles, some reviews, and some videos of interviews with me.
As you got into this, did you find more and more shocking things that they're doing?
Well, sure. I mean, the thing that's incredible is their willingness to stop technologies that would be of enormous benefit to mankind. We're just talking about nuclear power.
Yeah.
Another thing that's discussed at length in the book is DDT. You know, DDT was introduced by the U.S. Army during World War II as a way of stopping epidemics of insect-borne diseases affecting our troops and affecting the populations of the Axis countries who were being subjected to epidemics due to the destruction of sanitation systems. And then we used it to wipe out malaria in the American South and in Southern Europe and in much of Latin America and South Asia. And by 1970, according to the National Academy of Sciences, 500 million lives had been saved by DDT. And you would think people would like this. But some of these population controllers start writing in the 50s, you know, DDT is causing population explosion. Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, who wrote this book, Brave New World Revisited, in 1958, in which he starts ranting about how DDT is causing the population explosion. That's the same year that Rachel Carson is given the contract to write the book Silent Spring, where she says we have to stop DDT because it's killing the birds. Now, in fact, the birds weren't being killed. Bird populations in the U.S. were expanding rapidly in the 40s and 50s, precisely because of DDT, because the main cause of bird mortality in the wild is insect-borne diseases. But anyway, they banned it, and as a result, 3 million Africans, mostly children, die every year of malaria. We could have wiped out malaria completely and in Africa, just as we did in the American South, but it was stopped. And then you look at other things like genetically modified foods. We have now means to enrich cereal crops with vitamins, like, because, you know, the poorest people in the world, their diet is mostly cereals, and they suffer from many vitamin deficiency diseases as a result. For instance, vitamin A deficiency, which causes blindness and even death. And they've created varieties of rice called golden rice that has the carotene gene in it, the same as carrots, that provide vitamin A. And this would eliminate this completely. But the European greens, in particular, have made stopping genetically modified crops a big issue, and they have put through bans stopping third world countries from importing agricultural crops into Europe if those countries are using genetically modified crops. And since many third world countries cannot afford to give up the European market, this has blackmailed them into foregoing these improved crops, and as a result, millions of people are dying of vitamin deficiency diseases that wouldn't have to. It's incredible what these people propose to do. And their willingness to stop, you know, and then here you have the global warming thing, where they say basically we have to stop industrialization, which has been the key to rising living standards in every country for the past 200 years, is the Industrial Revolution. They want to turn back the clock. They want to ration the use of fire. And the whole thing is totally stupid because, you know, global warming, if it was true, it would be good. Global warming lengthens the growing season, increases net rainfall worldwide, and enriching CO2 increases plant growth. We have photographs taken from orbit since 1958, and they show that the rate of plant growth on Earth has accelerated by 14% since 1958. That's in parallel with a 19% increase in atmospheric CO2 levels. And we know that it's CO2 that's causing the acceleration of plant growth because you can repeat the experiment in the lab. Plants need CO2 to grow, and if you enrich the CO2 content in a terrarium, the plants will grow faster. They do. And so here they are. They're saying that, you know, shackles should be put on humanity because we're making the world a more fertile planet. I mean, what could be more revealing of their fundamental bias? These people.
How many of them are there out there, Robert? Hundreds? Well, thousands?
Well, look, you know, there's the dupes, the people who are just indoctrinated into this ideology because they're bombarded with it all the time in the press, this ideology that humans are destroyers and we must put limits on them because they're wrecking the planet. And in fact, people, you know, people who want to be good people, but they're given these bad ideas and they go off this way. In terms of the ideologues who really know where this goes, it's comparatively few. But in terms of the masses of people who, you know, basically embrace these ideas because they become fashionable, they become the ideas that all good people should believe in. You know, it's just like, you know, eugenics. We look at eugenics today and we say, this is awful. How could anyone have believed this? But at the time, eugenics was very fashionable, and all the people who were really with it were all for eugenics. So of course, we don't want to have the racial stock of humanity degrade. We clearly need government controls to stop this from happening. And I mean, Nazism was very fashionable in Germany. Nazism was not done behind the backs of the German population. 18 million of them voted for Hitler.
That's true. Let's go take some final calls. We'll go to Modesto, California. First-time caller, Stephen, you're on with Bob Zubrin. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hey, I got a question.
Sure.
I heard about a month or so ago, you had a guest on that talked about there was some person that owned the mineral rights to the moon. And I think if that's true, then he should let people drill with his mineral rights, because they also talked about that the only reason that people ain't really drilled on the moon is because I guess the moon's gravitation won't let no electronical devices land on the moon. And I was wondering if that's why we ain't drilled on the moon yet.
Well, there's no one owns the mineral rights of the moon, not all of it or even any of it. And that's somewhat of a problem. Now, we certainly wouldn't want anyone to be able to just claim the whole moon. But you want to, just like we don't let someone make a mining claim to an entire continent. But it would be good if we established laws that will let people make a mining claim to a local place on the moon, which they had discovered contained valuable resources, because then people would go exploring to make such claims, then they could sell the claims to larger companies that have the resources to go and mine them.
Indeed. Let's go to Gary, Seattle, Washington. Hi, Gary. Take it away.
Hey, Bob. I'm a real big space advocate guy, and I think probably the most thing that really formed my opinion is I read a book called Project Orion by George Dyson many years ago. And I also read an article by Eugene Parker called Shielding Space Travelers. So, and I've thought about it a lot. I think, like, you know, they got that water on the moon. We could go to the moon. And because it's outside the magnetosphere, we could use atomic bomb propulsion without contaminating the Earth. You know, we could get away with that. And we could also use the water on the moon as a massive water shield against radiation. And kind of like that's my thing is moon first and then go to other places. And I wonder why you like Mars so much. I thought Ceres might be a better place to go. If we had a really good spaceship that could go a long ways, why not go past Mars to Ceres? It's a lot easier to land on.
Well, the reason why Mars should be our goal is because Mars is the closest planet that has on it all the resources needed to support life and civilization. There is a little bit of water on the moon, but it's in craters that are at 40 degrees Kelvin. On Mars, there are continent-sized regions that are 60% water by weight in the soil. There's underground liquid water on Mars. Mars has got carbon dioxide in its atmosphere. There's almost no carbon on the moon. Mars has got nitrogen in the atmosphere. Mars has got a 24-hour day. Mars has had complex geological processes that could create concentrated mineral ore. Mars has got an atmosphere, which means the surface is shielded against solar flares. You know, if you want to compare the moon or Ceres to Mars, to the previous age of exploration, the moon compares to Mars as Greenland compares to North America. Greenland was closer to Europe. Europeans reached it first, but it was a much poorer environment to try to build a civilization than North America. And that's why Mars should be the goal. Mars is the grand prize. It's the new world. It's not just a rock.
Pete is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and now on Coast to Coast. Hi, Pete. Go ahead.
Two brief questions, Robert. Number one, since the success of the first privatized mission to space, do you feel that NASA, the federal government of America, or other governments in the world maybe got a little jealous? And there's a possibility on the next try or the next try after that, that there could be some tampering or sabotage by one of these entities to disgrace the private space company?
I think it's more likely that they'll be behind-the-scenes lobbying by SpaceX's competitors and certain people in NASA. There are people in NASA who love SpaceX, but there's those who hate it for the reasons you say.
That's true.
To have its funding cut or to deny it the right to launch from NASA facilities. They actually succeeded in doing that for a while. They relegated SpaceX to Kwajalein, which is an island in the middle of the Pacific, to do its launching from or to say we can't certify SpaceX to deliver astronauts to the station, even though the Dragon capsule is capable of it. So I don't think you'll see sabotage of the form of someone, you know, cutting the wires in the spaceship, but certainly political sabotage is entirely to be expected.
How close are we to see private astronauts up there doing, let's say, orbits?
Well, I think it's something that we might see. Elon Musk has not revealed to me his plans, but it is within the capability of SpaceX to fly a Gemini mission.
And within a few years, you think?
It's within their capability to do it, yeah, within a year.
That's pretty darn good. Are most of these employees that helped someone like Musk, are they former NASA employees who like got laid off from other programs?
Only in a few cases. He has some of them, for sure. But actually, the workforce at SpaceX is very young. I went over there. Musk gave me the tour, and it was amazing. I'd say the average age at SpaceX is about 28. They're very high morale. They're very committed. You walk into SpaceX, this is a gigantic picture of Mars on the wall, a photograph about 30 feet on a side. Everybody who walks into the place walks past that photograph. That's their goal. Musk is not doing this to make money. I mean, he'll make money doing it because he's good at making money. He could make money doing anything. But he'd make a lot more money doing more ordinary kinds of things.
Right. He made most of his money initially with PayPal, right?
That's right. And if he wanted to make a lot of money, he'd do other dot-coms and things, but he's doing this because he wants to do something really important with his life. He's looking for immortality, and opening the space frontier is the way to do it.
What's going on with his Tesla Motors? Because he has that going too, doesn't he?
He does. I'm less optimistic there. I do not believe ultimately that electric cars are the way to go. Thomas Edison invented the electric car. We've had electric cars longer than we've had gasoline cars. But, you know, when you fill up your car with gas at the pump, inside of a minute you can put enough energy in your car to take a 2-ton car and drive it every which way at 60 miles an hour all day. You can't put that much energy down a wire. So that's why I'm a big advocate of methanol fuel. And you may know that I demonstrated that we could take practically any car and convert it to run on methanol. I took a 2007 Chevy Cobalt looked inside of its computer and saw that it really was a flex fuel car, except the manufacturer had disabled the flex fuel programming, and we enabled it. We ran it on methanol. We got 24 miles to the gallon, which may not seem that much, except methanol goes for $1.20 a gallon without any subsidies. So that's like getting 60 miles a gallon with gasoline. And you can make methanol from natural gas. You can make it from coal. You can make it from any kind of biomass without exception. We and many other countries have the resources to make all the methanol we need. We could crash the price of oil if we simply passed a law requiring that the automakers enable the flex fuel programming in their cars. And when the car is put in the consumer's hand, it gives them fuel choice, and they have the ability to choose of running it on gasoline, methanol, and that would also give them the choice of ethanol as well. We could have a competitive fuel market. We could break OPEC. And there's a bill in Congress right now called the Open Fuel Standards Act to do exactly that. But the congressmen are too busy yelling at each other in order to do what's necessary for the nation. And so it's got about 20 co-sponsors from both parties, I might say. But the rest of them can't be bothered.
We've got Fred in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Fred. Thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, well, George, I sure would like to know the Senate or House bill number for the Open Fuel Standards Act. Everybody in the audience tonight, and this should be a recurring theme, George, because I believe in the Coast audience we have totally sufficient competency and energy and you know, dedication to get these barriers.
Well, let me give them to you real quick. The Senate bill is S-3303, and the House bill is H-R-6559.
No, the current House bill is 1687.
Now, what happened to the other one?
They change the numbers when they go from one Congress to another.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Yeah. H.R. 1687 is the current open fuel standards bill.
All right. For the House?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. A couple minutes to go here, Robert. Give me a little final summation here.
Yeah. The basic idea, what I try to explain in Merchants of Despair is, first of all, the Merchants of Despair are wrong. We're not running out of resources. All their predictions have always been proven wrong because human beings are always inventing new resources. And that's why, as the world's population has gone up, the standard of living has gone up, because the more people, the more inventors, the faster our progress. So we're not in danger of overpopulation. We're in danger from people who want to get rid of population. We're not in danger from running out of resources. We're in danger from people who won't let us use our resources. We're not in danger that we're destroying the weather. We're in danger of people who want to use weather changes as an excuse to put limits on our liberties. And so the fundamental issue between the anti-humanists and the rest of us is this. They say humans are destroyers, and therefore every new person in the world is an enemy to the rest of us. Every nation is the enemy of every other nation. Every race the enemy of every other race. And human liberty has got to be limited. Whereas we say human beings are creators, and therefore welcome aboard to every new person. And every nation is the friend of every other nation, fundamentally, at you know, in reality. And human liberty, rather than being something to be avoided, is something that must be protected at all costs. That's the ultimate message of Merchants of Despair.
Merchants of Despair, Robert Zubrin's book. Robert, what's new for you after this? What are your next plans?
Well, we're having the Mars Society Convention is going to be in Pasadena, California this year, August 3rd through 5th at the Pasadena Convention Center. Now, August 5th is when the Mars rover Curiosity lands on Mars, and the headquarters for that mission is Jet Propulsion Lab, which is in Pasadena. So we're having a lot of the scientists from JPL going to be coming over, speaking to the conference. We're going to be doing this conference in conjunction with the Planetary Society, which is having its conference in the same building, and we're negotiating arrangements with them to make it possible for people to go from one conference to the other easily. So this is going to be the largest Mars landing party in history. And people can find out about it by going to MarsSociety.org, and you should be there. As I say, it's going to be the largest Mars landing party in history, and it might be the last one for a while because the Obama administration has canceled the next two Mars missions. But you don't want to miss this one. This is like missing the last Apollo takeoff.
No, you don't. Thanks, Robert. Robert Zubrin, up next, we're going to be talking about the modern Book of the Dead on Coast to Coast AM.